Welcome into another episode of Debate Night. We are back once again. We've got three wonderful smiling faces today to debate all the great things happening in disc golf. New order today. We're doing a new order. Hunter's going first. He actually threatened me.
No.
And so therefore I had to put him in first or else things were going to get really ugly. He also caused a hacky sack to get burned in the office today, lit on fire. So
a lot of lies being spread this morning, but that's okay. You know what?
Yep. Long story.
What you got to do to get on top of the order?
Maybe we'll have to debate that later. But so we're going to get into the show today. We have quite a few topics today. A lot of things that are a little more related to some of the stuff that was getting thrown around on social media in the past week or so. But we're going to hop right into the first topic here. And this is one that was talked about quite a bit on Twitter. Some pros making quite a bit of a stink about this one. It's been discussed a lot now. And this is the PGA. The post heard around the world at this point. They made a sponsored post on Twitter. It was not necessarily an integration or anything. It was just very blatantly an advertisement, a billboard type post for a disc golf Kickstarter company. I think they're still Kickstarter, which basically makes 3D printed shelves for your disc. This has nothing to do with them. You know, they can stay out of this. This is really the PGA made this post. It caused quite a stink among players and fans. Some players getting really, really heated. Andrew Fish, I think, was one that was like, I mean, wrote a book to them, basically. And there was some defense as well, though, for the PDGA. So here's the question. Should they be making posts like this? Why or why not? Hunter?
Short answer is no. I don't think that they should. Mainly, it's the optics of it more than anything. I think if you boil it all the way down, like, I don't think there's necessarily anything technically wrong with it. They've been doing ads in the magazine for years and no one's batted an eye. They even did an Instagram sponsored post back like a month or two ago at the European Open. More than that now, no one batted an eye. But it's more so the optics of they're a nonprofit organization that exists to promote and grow the sport. So if this was executed in a way that supported that mission, no one would have thought anything of it. If this was executed in a way that, hey, this company is now the official storage partner of the PDGA, and because of that, we are now donating these to schools, and they're going to be able to be used to grow the sport in this way, shape, or form. It could have been executed probably even better for the company. Same bottom line effect for the PDGA, and it would have looked a lot better. But just throwing an ad read on Twitter seems like a very for-profit and monetary gain move by an organization that's not supposed to be about any of that. I think it's more so just the optics of an organization that already has some mistrust in the air. And then you throw this on and it doesn't really look good.
Well said. Well said. Brody, what do you think?
It's definitely a weird one. And what Hunter just said, or what you just said about like it was a billboard and stuff, those things are very different where, you know, you have an advertisement going on during maybe your world championships, or you have an advertisement, like Hunter said, in a magazine. That's very, very different than a sponsored post on your social media. And I think people aren't understanding, or the people that are saying like there's nothing wrong with this, I don't think people are understanding the difference between those two posts, one of which is a company coming in and saying, hey, we want to advertise our product, advertise our event, advertise whatever, and you're giving them a platform for that. And another one is like you're an influencer and you're telling your fans, hey, we are the PDGA, go buy this product. Those two are way different in the voice and how they're posted. And I'm with Hunter. I don't think it's a good look from the PDGA to be doing this.
That's a very good point. There is a difference in the communication there. Caleb, what were your thoughts on this post?
Initially, when I saw it, I knew immediately right away I was not a fan of this. As someone that is a board member and helped founded a 501c3, there are things I know that you can and cannot do. You can't accept money for advertisement when it comes to, you know, sponsorships, all that. I know when we run events, we'll sponsor tee boxes, all that. Great. You can do that. Legally, you can. Ethics wise, you have to be careful about things you can and cannot do. I think the biggest issue I see with this is it's in the same industry. In the same industry affecting, you know, disc golf. And, you know, PGA is using their pool to shove possibly, you know, extra backing to a Kickstarter. And to me, it really brings up a concern about financing in the PDGA. You know, how is their bottom line looking if they have to take into a sponsored ad? how, you know, and is it something that, you know, we know that we need to cut trees at IDGC, so we need this extra money, or is it something to where we can't make payroll, so we need to take this money? I think overall, you know, those are some of the biggest concerns. And I think really what we need to do from this is possibly go into a deeper ethics investigation to see all what's going on in the PGA, just to see, you know, is this just the only thing that could be possibly unethical, or are there more things that just aren't on the surface?
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. I think there's definitely a lot of questions surrounding the PDGA always about what are they accomplishing, where's the money going. They have a lot of members, and I think you brought up a good point there, Caleb. One of the big questions is why. You know, why did they feel like they needed to take this ad? Was it just, Brody? Do you have a point there?
Well, I was going to add, I just went back to find the European Open one because I didn't actually see that, and it looks like it's like this technology kind of flight thing with the disc. Mm-hmm. To me, again, it's like there's a massive difference between like an integration, because these people were at the European Open, so they were like on site. There's a mass, like the PDGA, in my opinion, if they would have done something with this disc with the pros that were there and showing off numbers and whatnot, and then just had that integrated into the post, that makes a lot more sense than just a picture of the disc saying, hey, go pre-order now.
Right.
Like those two things, it's just the voice.
The reason it stuck out so much was because of how lazy it was. Because even if they had done something like, look at all these new cool disc racks we got at PDGA headquarters, and then shouted them out, people would probably not have cared very much. It's how blatant it was that it just came off weird and a little bit lazy. And like Hunter said, the optics of it just weren't great. And it wasn't difficult to find a way to integrate that. Like at the end of the day, it is a disc golf product.
I'm worried I'm going to see on my TikTok feed Sully from the PDGA going, oh, thank you for the roses. Oh, thank you for the I'm terrified that we're not that far away from that.
They're doing an NPC streamer.
Oh, yes. That's funny. Gosh, that's funny. Hilarious. Oh my, that'll be the day. Okay. All right. We're going to move on to our next topic. Obviously, one of the...
I think I just got an extra point some randomly.
That was supposed to go to Brody. Yeah. I'm sorry.
You're welcome. Yeah.
I'm used to Brody being in green. It's an adjustment. That's my muscle memory. We're going to move on to the integrity from Hunter. Man, maybe he does need a point for that. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I don't deserve it.
One of the big events that went down, obviously, was Kristen just won the Kristen Slam, four majors, all four in 1 year, sweeping the majors in a crazy accomplishment. Her season just continues to be one for the history books. So this kind of stirred up a little bit of a talking point on social media. The disc golf season to end all seasons has been known by a lot of people as Paul McBeth's 2015 seasons, where I believe he took no worse. He had... Hunter, correct me if I'm wrong, one or two third places, and then was first or second in every other event, won a ton of tournaments. And so that's kind of been, for the longest time, known as the disc golf season to end all. But Kristen's 2023 season certainly enters that conversation. So I guess the question here is, which season is more impressive, McBeth's 2015 season or Kristen's 2023 season? Or I guess the alternative would be, is there just no reason or way to compare these, if you want to take that route? Brody, what do you think?
Obviously, I was not paying attention to disc golf in 2015. so I had to go back and kind of look at Paul's PDGA profile to see what went down in 2015. Hunter's correct. There's a lot of ones. Very few other numbers than ones next to his name. But for me, the easiest way to kind of do this, I guess, was I was just going to look at the four majors. There was four majors that he played in 2015. Kristen played in the four majors. We know what Kristen did, so let's look at what Paul did. Paul won the first major, which was the Aussie Open. There were 24 people in the field. Notable names that were in the top 10 were Simon Lizotte, Ricky Wysocki, Nathan Doss, and David Fellberg. Every other name on that list, I don't know any of these other names in the tournament. So it looks like there was like five people that he had to beat for
just call it a fake major.
Well, there's five people he had to beat. European Open, you had Paul McBeth winning, Ricky Wysocki, Jeremy Kohling, Will Schustrick. Then you had like Seppo, Nico, Nate Doss, Drew Gibson. That was your top 10. Then it kind of falls off after there. Worlds, Ricky, Will, Steve Brinster, Nico, Steve Rico, Yuli, Simon, all those guys are in the top 10. So I think you could compare, and then you have USCGC, which is Ricky, Nate Doss, Nate Sexton, Cole Glazer, Michael Johansson. I think you can compare the two decently in the idea that I still think the MPO field was probably deeper and a little stronger in 2015 than what the FPO field is now. So I think Paul's season was more impressive. But with that being said, the positive for FPO, if you want to look at it that way, is, you know, look where we are now. We're 8 years removed from 2015, and the field is way different now than it was then. So I think the FPO has a lot to look forward to in the next 5 to 10 years of the field continuing to grow. I think obviously what Kristen did was impressive, probably the most impressive things any FPO player has done to this point. I still just think the field in 2015 was probably a little bit more challenging what the field is now. I mean, we're watching her biggest competitor miss putts from 10 to 15 feet. That's tough.
Fair point. Caleb, what do you think?
When looking at these just objectively, Paul's average finish in 2015 was 1.3. Kristen's was 1.8. Paul finished a half a place better than her on average. When the podiums, Paul didn't get off podium. Kristen, she has missed podiums 3 times now. She's, you know, gotten 15 out of 18. Paul did play an extra 5 events. He played 23 events that season. Kristen so far has only played 18. She still has another 2 to go. But still, we see, you know, that's a lot more just in and out, week in, week out. We're going and winning more and more. I really looking at this, like, it's very just remarkable how dominant these players have been. But, you know, I've got to give the win to Paul on this. I think optics-wise and what we really need to focus on when it comes to narrative, Paul made $69,000 that year in winnings. You know, winning that much. Kristen, so far, $100,000, I think $90. We need to really start asking ourselves, is Kristen going to eclipse her salary if she wins out? She's getting paid $125,000 a year salary to play, and she could possibly make more than that if she wins, what, at least tour championship. And, you know, even adjusted for inflation, Paul's only, you know, 2015 wins only came out to about 89,000, which is still a hefty chunk of change. But, you know, I think because of that, and also because of the fact that when we look at Paul that year, it wasn't just US, it wasn't just Europe. He also traveled to Australia. I mean, he traveled all over the place and won. If you've ever traveled for, you know, any period of time, traveling will take it out of you. And to be able to travel that much and still be dominant, I got to give it to Paul.
Fair enough. It also was a grittier era as well. There was not as much money flying around. People were driving everywhere. Definitely different times. Hunter, what are your thoughts on these two seasons?
Going third here, I really wish I could make a case for Kristen, but I can't. The best thing I can do is actually expand on some points that I think were left on the table here. One being Caleb brought out that Macbeth played more events than Kristen, which is a true statement. But what he failed to bring up was that Macbeth also has a greater win percentage, which makes it even more impressive because he played more events and won a bigger percentage of them at 77% versus Kristen's 69% average. We did mention Paul never finished also off the podium, whereas Kristen has multiple times. Now, the other thing that can be brought up is, you know, two of the majors Macbeth played, the Scandinavian Open and the Aussie Open, aren't majors anymore. So, like, that's the only knock you can have against it. And as Brody pointed out, the Aussie Open field, really a lot of the major fields back then were, did I just say Scandinavian Open?
Yep.
Yeah, it was still European.
European. Or was it called Scandinavian? Doesn't matter.
No,
European and the Aussie Open field, obviously a lot weaker than they are in the modern era, but every field Paul went against did have players at the top that I think he had to beat more players than Kristen does as far as like head-to-head matchups. Because realistically, I mean, you put Schustrick and Ricky or Nate Doss and one other player, Seppu Paju, Brody mentioned him. He was filthy back then. Unfortunately, he's retired since then. You have two or three players in the field at each of these majors. And unfortunately for the current FPO field, that's probably 3 times more than Kristen has to beat, being one person, week in and week out. So I wish there was a way to argue it as Kristen. Kristen has the greatest FPO season of all time, but it's not, in my opinion, it's not even close to the greatest season of all time. I think you might even be able to take another one of Macbeth's seasons and look at it closely as was it a better season against Kristen, just based on field strength. But the 2015 season, no one's ever going to touch it. It's impossible, I think, to do that again.
Okay, so the verdict is definitely that 2015 season, Brody.
I was just going to say, when you look at those fields back in that 2015 season, you still had the same kind of guys finishing in the top five week in, week out.
No, correction. Paul did win five majors. The Scandinavia Open was the fifth major. Paul won five majors in 2015. I knew I wasn't crazy.
I didn't even see.
He won the USDGC World Scandinavia Open. But C tiers back then were a little. I think it was like the winter time, but it was Scandinavian Open, European Open, USDGC, Worlds, Aussie Open.
Wait, is that the year that Lance Brown beat him at wintertime? Surely not.
No. That was still during his wintertime era. It was like a warm-up event. I think it was the first event of the season he came out and took
it. It was the Aussie Open.
It was the Aussie Open warm-up.
Yeah, he took a third.
Okay.
It was the first thing.
He won the real one.
Yeah.
So the only extra point I was going to add was like when you look at those majors that you know, we were just talking about with Paul, you kind of had the same names at the top each week, and they were pushing, obviously, Paul with a Ricky coming up the next couple years winning Worlds. He had to beat kind of the same guys that were always at the top. I think with Kristen, the only person that we have seen consistency like her this season has been Owen Scoggins, who has a massive disadvantage with Kristen with her distance. And we just see like a carousel of some kind of people like, Paige was up there. Paige fell down. Katrina was up there. Katrina fell down. We've seen Holland and Ella kind of a little bit. We've seen Val a little bit. Haley King, and then all of a sudden they like get 25th. And like in the fields that the FPO currently have, we shouldn't be seeing them drop outside the top 10, maybe even the top five. But we do week in and week out, and so that's where it's just like with Kristen, it's a little bit harder to give her the nudge here because of the competition she's having to do. It's nothing against her. It's just the competition she has to go against.
Well, that segues us into our next topic, talking about Kristen's dominance. And if not her dominance, then maybe the lack of dominance from the rest of the field. This has been going on, obviously, for an entire season now. It kind of started up a little bit last year, but this season has just been the extreme example. So my question is Kristen's dominance boring or beneficial? And if you don't think it's boring at this point, could it become so? Is it going to, let's say she does for two more years, is it going to become boring or is it already? Caleb, what do you think?
I think right now that Kristen and her dominance is very beneficial for the PGA and the FPO when it comes, or DGPT and the FPO. When it comes to, will it get boring? I think it will if no one rises to the occasion. Currently, if I'm FPO, I'm going home this offseason and I'm using this season as fuel. No one got, really even that close to her when it came to majors. She swept this year. I'm using that as fuel of what I am winning next year. She was just outright dominant. I think some parts of the season she had entering into the event round one, a 79% win percentage. That's just ridiculous. I mean, that means that, hey, I've got 1-2% chance of winning. I'm using this fuel. I think right now, during the Paige Pierce, when she was really popping off, everyone was just, I've got to get better at distance. Haley King said it best at MVP. That last round, I had to start playing like Kristen. I had to start managing that course. I had to start playing golf. And I think that's what we really are going to start seeing is these players are going to be improving those putts. If I'm Evelina, if I'm Henna, I'm going back overseas and I am putting my brains out this offseason. I think right now we've got three challengers. Really, when it comes to Kristen, that could pop up and rival her in the next year or two. Let's say that's Owen, that's Missy, and that's Haley King. All those three have been challenging her this entire year. And they just need a little bit more fine tuning to really, be in and out with her every week. I mean, Owen is one of the best putters in FPO. And that really makes me concerned when it comes to the FPO field of if putting is such a weakness that, hey, Kristen, she's a great putter or sometimes even just above average putter and she's winning left and right. That really should tell you a lot about what's going on in FPO. Missy, I think it's just a little fine tuning. And then Haley King, I think once she gets back into that Kristen, mindset, tune up her game a little bit, I think we're going to have a great season next year and possibly going forward if they can rise to the occasion.
There's certainly players that can get to that point, we'd hope. But, Yeah, definitely not the case at this point. Hunter, what do you think about this era of dominance we're in?
Well, first off, I'd like to just say I think Ohm-Scoggins' era of competition is slowly coming to an end. Courses are only getting longer, and she's only getting older, and she's not going to gain any distance as that happens. I also think, you know, Hannah and Evelina, you mentioned, we can't just throw Paige out completely, and I'm still riding with Katrina Allen. She's got the talent. She just has to figure out how to put it into practice. But regardless, throw all of that out the window, because that's a whole side point. Kristen's dominance beneficial for sure. I think that dominance might seem boring from the outside, but it draws views. The engagement and storylines from FPO, I think, this year have been better than a lot of recent years. And that's because the dominance that we're seeing from Kristen, it's similar to the dominance we saw of Paige. It pushes the sport forward. It is also long-term beneficial. Macbeth's dominance is the easiest example to look at directly in our sport. In his 2015 season, we were just talking about, force the field to kind of make a decision, either step your game up or be left behind. And the way he carried himself as a professional athlete is very similar to what we're seeing from Kristen Tatar in the FPO field right now. And it changed the way you looked at professional disc golf. Literally, it changed the way they dressed. So that's one thing. But it also changed the way they carried themselves in the offseason and how seriously they took the sport, which led to a much deeper field. So I think Brody brought it up actually in the last point, and I think he's spot on, where what Kristen is doing right now is pushing the field forward to, if you're a Sayananda, if you're a Haley King, if you're a Missy Gannon, you, Valerie Mandahano, Alexis Mandahano, you have a decision to make this offseason of, I have to step up my practice routine. I have to treat myself, treat my nutrition, treat my warm-up, my training, all of that as a professional athlete, or get left behind. And what that does is it pushes the field forward, it makes the field deeper, and in turn, it creates a much more exciting field down the line.
Yeah, fair enough. It always helps to push that field. Brody, what do you think?
I've got two examples here. First one is, I used to play this free ice cream. We get ice cream, you know, the ice cream truck shows up on Wednesday at our camp. And so I would buy ice cream for any kid that could score on me in a one-on-one basketball game. And we would drop the basket down to like 8 feet so they could actually, you know, shoot. We're talking about, you know, 7 to 12-year-olds. And I'm sure if you brought an audience in for the first couple, it would be very exciting because you're like, oh my God, is he going to score? No, swatted. Oh my God, is this kid going to? No, swatted. At a certain point, though, that gets very boring to watch when you're like, no one has a chance. The other example I have is I'm looking at Serena Williams, who is probably the most dominant, I would say, female athlete of all time. She never actually won the Grand Slam, which I didn't know. She was close a couple times. She won 3 of the 4 in 2002, but wasn't at the Australian Open. And then the other time that she won 3 was in 2015, where she got booted at the U.S. Open in the semifinals. So she actually never even won the Grand Slam. But when I'm looking even at like 2015, for example, where she won 3 of the 4, the match in the first match was 6-3, 7-6. She won in a tiebreaker. The next match was 6-3. She lost the second set, 6-7, then won the third, 6-2. And then she won 6-4, 6-4. And then she lost, obviously, in the semifinals. So even in the matches that she won, there was some little bit of like, uh-oh, what's going on? I think the big issue too with FPO, a lot of times when we watch, it's like at the end, you know, with the Hannah, for example, or like Ohm-Scoggins, go back to MVP. Like Ohm-Scoggins could have won MVP. She four putted out on one of the holes. That a lot of times is kind of the narrative going down the stretch, is like, who's not going to mess up, versus where, like, I guess you could say Haley Kane kind of took it there towards the end, but still took Kristen Tatar to mess up. Versus we haven't really seen that many like head-to-head, like banger, 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 back and forth. And I think that's what we're missing. And I think Hunter's right. The field is going to probably step up or get left behind. And I think we're going to see more of those battles down the end. I mean, heck, yeah. Sayananda was a name out there that I was like, she was the Kristen Tatar killer at the beginning, right? She took Kristen Tatar down head-to-head at Texas State. Never saw her again the rest of the season. No idea what happened there.
Hunter?
I would just like to point a little bit of a hole in Brody's ice cream argument,
which is
in the ice cream argument, the 7-year-olds never scoring, 12-year-olds never scoring. Mm-hmm. What makes the dominance?
They did score a couple times, and it was like, shirts off.
But that's what I'm saying. Around,
kids missing them up, like they're the king of the kids. It would happen every once in a while.
That's what makes the dominant era of Kristen Tatar exciting and not boring. Is she has fallen. a few times. Yeah. So there is that chance. Even going into the final round of U.S. Women's, it got to tied up through like eight holes. Like it was, it is exciting because there is that chance. If she was literally showing up and winning by 15 strokes every week, then yeah, it would be boring. But that's not what's going on.
Yeah, certainly helps when there is some competition.
The missed short putts are really tough. That's a killer.
Yeah, it is tough whenever. Yeah, it gets tight, and then there's just like the silly mistakes. We would like to see more stiff competition to the end, but yeah.
The biggest problem is when you have someone have like a 12 footer, they take like 30 seconds to putt, they miss, and then the person right after them steps up and has the same distance, and they don't take any time, and they just tap it in, and they show like how easy that is. That like contrast between the two is really hard to watch.
Give another point, Caleb.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think Kristen this season more than anything has painted a target on her back because of that. Like, I know when Missy Gannon, I believe, came on Tour Life, she was just going, you know, yeah, I can beat Kristen. That drives a lot of, in my opinion, drama towards the sport of, and she actually is Missy just talking smack, or is she actually gonna, you know, rise to the occasion?
Yeah, it's a real thing of like, if there is one player that everybody is trying to beat and it's clearly that one player, there's a target there. And hopefully, you know, like you guys were all kind of touching on it, it causes everybody going to the off season with Kristen Tatar dartboards, essentially. Like, that's who we're all going for next year. We need to rise to that level and beat Kristen. And that just really speaks to Kristen's dominance, that she's become that player. Certainly going to be interesting to see, you know, each season we will enter with new hopes to see if people will emerge, but we'll just kind of have to watch. All right, we're going to pivot a little bit into our final subject before elimination. I thought this one was a little bit of an interesting topic. So the Disc Golf Network, and I've seen this thrown around a little bit on social media and from the stats providers, but the Disc Golf Network recently aired a stat. I don't remember the exact stat, but they've done this before where they cited the modern era of disc golf. And I think this is an interesting talking point because I think a lot of people would have different definitions for what is the modern era of disc golf. Some would probably say since the early 2000s, some would say since the Pro Tour, and some would say we're not in the modern era of disc golf. It probably hasn't even arrived yet. So I'd wonder from each of you, what would you consider the modern era of disc golf? If you were stat keeping and you had to write a stat that needed to cite kind of the modern era, quote unquote, as they called it, what would you consider that era, Hunter?
First off, I'd like to say my brain just unlocked how the carousel works. I was going the other way last week. So I am team Trevor now. I get it. I understand why I'm going first here. I was literally just doing the math in my head, looking at the names at the bottom of the screen. And I was trying to go from here over to here versus you're just going boop, 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 boop.
Yep.
Anyways, you can use that as part of my time. Modern era, I don't know what they technically consider it, where that comes from. If they just, I think they just threw it out there, just kind of, I don't think they have a set date. In my opinion, going forward, when people refer to the modern era, I think they will probably end up calling it the Pro Tour era, or it'll probably just end up being just the stats. Cause I think what technically makes the most sense is for the modern era to start when the Pro Tour started in 2016. Because, for instance, we just the other day were talking about the Arizona Cardinals and their drought or whatever, and we had to look up because when they won their championship, it was pre-NFL-AFL merger, and it didn't even make any sense because in modern-day sports, when we talk NFL, we don't talk about pre-NFL-AFL merger. That was so far back there. I think that's kind of what we're looking at is we're not going to look at in the future the National Tour, World Tour, all that stuff that was going on before the Pro Tour. We'll see the Pro Tour is kind of the start of the modern professional scene. So I think the modern era going forward is basically just going to be the Pro Tour era. So 2016 would be the start of that. I don't think that's what they were using, but I think that'll kind of be what it is in the long term.
Very good point. Very good point. Brody, what do you think is the modern era? Whenever you started playing?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a good question. I have flipping no idea. I think, though, what I will say to it is I think when you're looking at sports, I think there are, like Hunter said, there are mergers or certain things like that. Like, I think basketball went through something very similar with, like, their TV rights and everything that kind of changed the landscape of basketball. I think there are big pivotal moments. Though that can also be technology, right? Tennis used to be played with wooden rackets. Golf used to be played with wooden clubs. Disc golf used to be played with much slower, bigger discs. Like, I think when you change technology, I think that needs to be accounted for. And then I think the other big one for me, and this is why I don't think it should go back as far as 2016, is the one that jumps out at me is like money. So you still had probably a lot of people in 2016 that were touring part-time, that had full-time jobs, and they would, you know, bounce out to a tournament here and there. We're not seeing that anymore from any of the top guys. If you're in the top 50 in the world and you're on tour right now, you don't have a 9-to-5 job. You're not doing other things. You're focusing on disc golf and disc golf alone. And I think that is a massive jump. If anyone's out there that has a 9-to-5 job and they're trying to get better at disc golf, they know how hard it is because it's so limited to how much time you have. I think that also is a big jump is, and I don't know what year exactly that, maybe that happened 2018, 2019, 2020. But we are seeing guys no longer part-time tour. We're seeing guys come on tour full-time. And I think that makes a huge difference.
The full-time tour era, if you will. Yeah, it's going to be like the Michael Jordan played against plumbers argument is going to be in disc golf. It's going to be like Ken Klima was a general contractor. Like, well, I guess he was the one winning.
To be fair, though, he was the one doing it.
Yeah,
too.
Ron Russell was a roofer. So
is that
Ken
right?
Klima playing against roofers.
Be like Ken Klima playing against roofers.
I think he owns a roofing.
There's going to be all kinds.
Klima was also doing that himself.
That's
so
true.
Fair,
I think he was a
kind of a fair field.
Ken Klima covered the goat argument by just doing this. He was a general contractor, yes. So he did all the work that all the other guys were doing.
If it comes out that Michael Jordan was a plumber, Trevor, will you call him the goat over LeBron?
Yes.
All right. I got some research to do.
Was a plumber at the same time. That's yeah,
during
me,
his
that's
career.
I got to do some research there. I'll find it.
Okay. All right, Caleb. What do you think? What do you define the modern era as?
If I'm to open up the disc golf history book and start writing, I believe the modern era actually starts in 2012. Okay. That's really before what everyone else is saying. But I believe eras are defined by innovation and dominance. And 2012 is really when we started seeing the dominance of Paul Macbeth. And I believe we're still in that era. I don't know where exactly on that timeline we may be, but I believe that's where we currently are. We're in that modern era. And if we look back, Ken Klimo, his really last few years playing was 2010, 2011. Okay, that was kind of the end of his era. And, I think we see that in 2007, 2011, we start seeing this transition period. We see Avery Jenkins winning. We see Nate Doss, we see Eric McCabe. And then, they kind of have their little time period. They go on. But, when we start in 2012, it's that dominant of Paul Macbeth of, I'm going to win four worlds just back to back to back. Start of an era isn't just immediate, like, oh, yeah, we've got, live streaming now. 2012, that's really when we started uploading videos to YouTube, online platforms to show the mass media. And I really think that's kind of when that era started. And the dominance of Paul Macbeth helped spur that on. Still in that. And the technology is just improving. We're seeing now we've got the DGN. That's just improvement in the modern era. And we, the next era, who knows what happened. But I know we're not starting off at this grandeur place and then, going downwards. You start small and you grow. That's really the thing of an era is it grows up. It matures.
Yeah, good point.
How much different does stuff have to be for it to be out of an era? Because it feels like talking with some of the guys about 2012, 2013, whatever year you just said. That's over 10 years ago. I feel like a lot of people would say that the disc golf pro tour, what it is right now, is way.
Well, maybe
different.
he's saying that was the modern era, and the modern era ended at some point.
Oh, so we're in. But I think I think he was saying we're still in the same era.
Caleb, are we still in the same era?
I think we're in the back half. I think not the back half, but I think we're in the back of the modern era. Like we're coming from the modern era into a new. Because I'm defining the era by. Maybe not the future era, but maybe. But I think like an era is marked by dominance. I mean, we talk about the Showtime Lakers. We talk about the six-time Bulls. I mean, that was an era.
Feel like an era is kind of ending right now. If you talk about, like you mentioned, dominance, because we do see the players kind of turning over the field a little bit. So that is a fair point, and it is a very good point about
the YouTube thing as well. The problem is the word modern, because like the modern era is always whatever era you're in. So like in the future, they'll probably use modern era again, and it'll define something that hasn't started yet.
I think
But no, that's not your fault. That's what the Pro Tour did. Because I think what you described is like the Jomez and Macbeth era. Because Jomez, the first video they put out was 2012 Paul Worlds, and that also kind of signified the start of that, and that led to it. That's why, like, I was saying the Pro Tour era, because like I don't think you can really ever define something as the modern era, because shocker, it's going to be modern again, and the next time. So modern era is just, I think, the wrong terminology that the Pro Tour used.
That's fair enough. Good points all around. All right, here's the thing. Brody and Caleb are tied before elimination round. If you guys haven't figured it out yet, I've kind of lost my mind when it comes to tiebreakers and rules and such. So here's how we're going to do this.
We're just going to eliminate Hunter.
No. I'm going to give Brody and Caleb each a random spelling bee word, and whoever gets closest gets to go on to the final round. Are you ready?
Heck yeah.
Caleb, your word is lullaby.
Oh, L-U-L-L-A-B-Y-E.
Oh, I'm out.
Very close. It's not an E on the end.
There's no E.
But you did do very well, so I'll consider that. You're one off.
I thought it was a silent E.
That was a... Wow.
I thought he got that right. I was going home.
Well, I thought he did too. I should have just cut him off before he got to the E.
And yeah, he just added that.
Okay. Dang it.
Brody, let me find a word that is a fair comparison here. How do you feel,
Brody,
about
your
spelling?
Word is dark
How do you
horse.
Feel about your spelling skills?
I'm terrible at spelling.
Your word is tourniquet, as in the thing they use to stop the bleeding to tie on you. Tourniquet.
T-U-R-N-I. A-I-T.
This is a fair enough guess. That is incorrect. It's Q-U-E-T, and it starts T-O-U. But you're on the right track.
Okay, those two words are vastly different.
Yeah, lullaby is a lot easier. Yeah.
I would have spelled both of them wrong.
When I had this idea, I was going to give you a really hard word and then give Caleb a word like shoe or cat or something. So I at least was a little more subtle, but... All right.
I don't know if I've ever seen tourniquet spell.
I don't know that I have either. No. All right. On to the rapid fire round. You can tune in for debate night for spelling bees every single time. That was fun. That was electrifying. All right. We're in the rapid fire round now. Hunter with the 1 point lead. Caleb, have you been to the finals before?
Yeah. I think last time I was on, I was actually on the finals.
Okay. Never mind.
Yeah, get lit, Trevor.
Yeah. He's experienced. All right. We've got some kind of interesting questions here. I feel like this is just an absolute grab bag. We are playing with the same rules as last week. And just like I did for last week's contestants, I'm going to tell them to you right in front of you. You have 45 seconds to make your point. For every second that you go over, you're going to lose a point. So if you think you might be getting close, you might want to take a gander at your points and make sure they're not decreasing. Or set your timer or whatever you need to do. All right, Hunter, would you like to go first or second?
I'd like to go first.
Okay, here is the question. So the reason I wrote this question is because we've talked about standardizing baskets on the Pro Tour for a very long time. But just recently, I've seen a lot more people talking about the tee pads as if they might be a greater issue. So my question is, which is more important for the tour now? Let's just say they had the option to do one or the other, standardized tee baskets or standardized tee pads. Hunter.
Standardized tee pads, I think, are more important because of player safety and consistency out there. Baskets are important for the score, but they aren't going to rid the possibility, or they don't have the possibility of ridding our sport of one of the all-time greats the same way that a tee pad could. Kevin Jones' ace at Maple Hill, for instance, was incredible, but that easily could have and maybe even should have been a career-ending injury. And he's not the only one that's fallen on those tee pads. To me, I think player safety should take priority over scoring, because without players, scoring doesn't matter.
Fair point. I definitely a good point there. Caleb, do you agree?
Yeah, I definitely do agree. I think that when we look at tee boxes, that really is player safety. I think it's a travesty that we have some tee boxes that have paver bricks that you can just move as the earth moves. I think Adio said it best. We need rounded tee boxes. It allows a player to attack in any angle they want to. As well, I believe that, you know, when we look at baskets and that side of the argument, I believe we can use that as actually a way for courses to make money in, hey, if you want to be on my course, you can pay this much money and you will get DGPT fee time. I think that really would be a great way of DGPT or the courses being self-sustaining. And then also for player safety, just make better boxes, standardized tee box for the tour.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with both of you. I think that the tee boxes makes the most sense. What do we think about tee boxes? Do we go turf? Do we go cement? Do we just standardize the dimensions? Are there options? That's the interesting question. I don't know.
I think that's got to be like voted on by like a player council.
Yeah, I guess the player. Brody, what would your vote be? If you were able to set the exact specifications for the tee box that's going to be used at every course, what's the material and what's the dimensions?
I like really good turf, but I think if you go really good turf, I think you just have to have a tent over them. And I think Matty O is right with the circle. That way you can, you know, adjust
you
your
like
angle.
The circle.
But a big, big circle turf with tents over them so they don't get wet when it rains.
Okay. All right. You're here first. And that would be a definite.
I'm looking
change
up other words to spell.
Okay. Just in case I need them. All right. We're going to move on to the next topic here. So we talk a lot about the Pro Tour stops and, you know, where they are currently. But I was kind of curious as to which state, city, or course, if you want to get really specific, needs a Pro Tour the most that doesn't have one yet. Where should one be planted? Caleb, what do you think?
Looking at this, I would have to say Utah. I think Ogden, Utah has a great course that can be on the tour. And I think it bridges that gap from Dino over to the West Coast and OTB. I think that'd just be a great logistically. It's smart. It bridges that gap, gives your players another event. It can take the load off of another event that may be going on later in the season in case whether anything happens. I would love to see one in Alabama, you know, come at Cactus Rock, the one that Paul McBeth is designing as a bridge between Texas to Champions Cup. But overall, though, I'd have to say Utah and Ogden in Ogden.
Yeah, that one definitely makes a lot of sense. Hunter, where do you think one should go?
I think the obvious answer here is Florida. In my opinion, I think the tour should start in Florida. I think Florida has a lot of disc golf history down there in general, but also a strong enough scene. And the big key with Florida that, no offense to Ogden, Utah, it doesn't have, being the armpit of Utah, is Florida has a lot of tourist attractions. So if you put an event in Florida to kick the season off in February, Florida in February sounds real nice. So even just spectators alone are going to be a lot more interested in making the trip down to Florida in February, kick the season off. And then logistically, it makes sense. Start in Florida, head across the southern Midwest, up the, you know, West Coast, and then across the northern into the Northeast, and then down and finish in Charlotte. I think that Florida is the one that needs it.
I do have to say that Ogden is, how do I say this?
The armpit of Utah.
Yeah, not great, other than the disc golf course.
Pizza shop.
And yeah, shout out the pizza shop. I don't know what it was called, but you can find it. It's like the only notable thing there.
Like Stillwater or something.
Something like Slackwater?
Slackwater. No, Slackwater.
Oh
pizza.
My gosh. Not a sponsored video, but holy cow, it changed my life. that might be worth the Pro Tour stop just for that place,
you
honestly.
Know what? Never mind. Give it to Caleb.
Yeah, I'm going to have to give you another point. Slackwater pizza.
Dang it.
You shouldn't have said anything. All right. Final topic here. So this is kind of a talking point because of what's happening at WR Jackson, that major getting shifted around. There's been whispers of USDDC and Winthrop Gold. How long will they be able to play at that university and so on and so forth? So my question here is, should the tour shy away from one course majors to avoid uprooting and loss of prestige in the case of them not being able to use a property or property getting damaged or whatever the case might be? Hunter, what do you think?
I don't think necessarily that the sport should shy away from one course majors, but I don't think it's something that every major should be. I think the problem we have right now is three of our four majors are one course majors, and two of them are, I guess, at question as well. But I think that it should be something that we aim to establish majors on properties that are focused on disc golf and privately owned to minimize that risk. But the history of a single course majors can't be beat. The best example of this is the Masters in golf. I mean, even non-golfers know it's in Augusta and will tune in from time to time. They know the general time of the year. And sure, something could happen to Augusta Nationals, but that's the risk that you just have to take to be willing to build the type of prestige that the Masters has. And with rotating majors, if it had a theme, it could help do that. But in disc golf, we haven't seen it yet. And so,
yeah, that was a very close one there. That was a very close one. I had to look down at my stopwatch to make sure, but you were like right on the end. That was a good points. Good points. You made it just to the end of your time.
I had
limit.
Like two more words, but
I respect it though. You got almost to the end there. All right, Caleb, what do you think about the majors?
I think that if they are privately owned and also self-sustaining properties, yes, we should have it on one course majors. However, the issue of self-sustaining, being able to stay open, stay profitable, I think that's something we need to look into. And then when we get to, you know, should be we be rotating? I believe we do, but it needs to be on a 3 to 5 course rotation. And Hunter, on your point of does each major have a theme? I think they do. Champions Cup shows who has the best control. European Open, who has the best at adapting. When it comes to USDGC, it's that course management. And then we get to Worlds, it's the best all around. World's biggest travesty is that it's either at a all open course or all wooded course. It needs to have the best of both worlds. So I really do believe if we go to a patient, that's what needs to be.
I think you contradicted yourself a little bit.
I think
there.
The events have a theme because they're at one course. Worlds is the only rotating course, and that's why it sucks and doesn't have a theme. That's my problem with rotating.
Yeah, no, the idea there, it was just that you said Worlds Test is the all-around game, but then you said it only goes to an all-open or all-wooded course.
Well, see, that's the travesty of it. That's like
so you
when
said
we see
that's
that, like,
what it should do is what you meant. Like, that's what the Worlds should do.
Yes, it should be at kind of like a smuggler's notch or a fort, you know, in Austin. It should not be EDO.
Yeah, I think honestly, I think we just need to secure the funding and build the property here in Virginia that just attract the majors. We'll draw some in. Anyways, that is going to do it for the episode. Hunter is victorious today by a slim margin. How you feeling about that, Big Hunt?
I feel good.
Is it just because you went first though?
I want to just bring this up to the people, you know, because now that I've seen both sides of the argument, I understand where I was wrong last week. What do we think of instead of you go first at your advantage, you immediately go to last, instead you're going last and you next go first? What's the bigger disadvantage versus advantage? You know what I mean? Like, is Caleb at a bigger disadvantage? Where is he at over here going last and then second and then or last? Should he go first next versus me go first and then I go second, then I go third? You know what I'm saying?
Something to think about.
I don't know exactly what I'm arguing, but it doesn't matter. I understand where I was wrong last week. Mm-hmm. It's just, did I accidentally create something better?
Whoever's is going to have the silver event people coming after him, though, after giving you points for saying that Florida doesn't have any tour events.
No, people know my stance on Florida. There's no tour events. There's silver events. There's no tour events.
I know, but Trevor also now agrees with you that the silver event in Florida doesn't count because he asked a question about what state needs a tour event, and you gave a state that has a tour event.
But Trevor, when you were writing that question, were you thinking silvers or were you meaning actual pro tour events?
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's just what it is. You got to understand the lingo.
You're going to have the silver people come after you.
Here's the thing, though. The New World, that's what's there. The New World, that should be a pro tour.
Also throw down the mountain.
I'm rooting for you guys. I'm rooting for you guys. But whoever, the silver committee, I'm not rooting for them. Not one bit. All right. That's going to do it for this week's episode. Hopefully you enjoyed. We will be back next week. Next week, we'll probably be previewing. Look at that. Corgi view. Next week, we'll probably be previewing some USDGC, talking about that. And then I'm sure the following week, we'll have a lot to debate about it because there's always some good stuff going down at USDGC. And as always, if it's good, 3 corgis. We'll see you next week.